Previously on the Bus Inspectors podcast.
They love the liveries and the smell, everything about it, the look of it, the shape, and people just find it fascinating.
All aboard for a trip to Routemaster 70.
Anywhere you go in the world, you say London Bus, people go, ah, Routemaster.
How have so many Routemasters survived?
There are something like 1,600 Routemasters out of the 2,893 built. It's implausible that they can all survive the next 50 years.
And what might the future hold?
The Big Red Bus Bar.
Find
us on Facebook.
Working out which ones most deserve to be in collections for the future is a really sensible thing to do.
We met Claire, lover of the Leyland National and owner of three.
They've got a very distinctive clattery sound.
All the same, or each one special?
It's special to us because of all the good days out we've had, the blood, the sweat, the tears, the good times, the bad times, the breakdowns.
And in this episode,
we've debated every possible thing we could find.
Come with us behind the scenes as the bus inspectors continue their project to grade the nation's historic buses and coaches.
B340 has now been in preservation for 100 years.
Do others grade their heritage?
We, as the Railway Heritage Trust, worked with Network Rail and Historic England to do a survey and decide which ones should be saved.
We'll consider the challenges of preserving 21st century buses.
They rely a lot more on computers than ever before, and it's actually quite dangerous to work on them yourself.
And a contentious contender for Britain's most significant bus of all time.
It's possibly a bit overlooked, you know, it's a humble single decker, it's a modern bus, it's built from the late 1980s onwards. It doesn't look as iconic as a Routemaster on the streets of London, but there have been more of them on the streets of London alone than there ever were Routemasters, let alone in the rest of the country.
Whatever could it be?
If I have some worries about the future, is that we won't be able to save everything.
There are quite a lot of vehicles which are similar to each other.
There are some challenges about the age and diversity of the people who are keen on them.
We're not getting younger people coming in to take over from us. And when I say younger, I'm talking about under 50.
There just won't be the space, or the facilities, or the materials, or the skills, or the money to keep them all going.
Throughout the series so far, we've been hearing about future challenges facing bus and coach preservation in the UK. There's a growing agreement among museums, charities, and many private bus owners too, that we need to be ready with an overview of the heritage in our custody, what the vehicles represent, and not just to the people who remember them, but how they might be valuable to future generations in demonstrating the past. This is why, at the start of 2024, the National Association of Road Transport Museums embarked on the Bus Inspectors project to list, score, and ultimately grade the nation's bus and coach treasures. Since the launch, the Bus Inspectors have been working with 10 major museums and collections across the UK, with the help of vehicle owners, museum curators, and other knowledgeable guides. The bus inspectors have applied their unique scoring and grading system to each of the vehicles in turn. The aim is to identify which of the nation's historic vehicles are most significant in telling the story of how buses and coaches have developed, and with them, our lives. The bus inspectors consider material aspects of the vehicle, its chassis, the bottom bit, and its body type, the bit we see. They consider how typical that pairing was in its era, as well as any landmark design features that the vehicle displays. They consider history and context, whether aspects of the vehicle design enabled social change in the communities it served, or changes to operational practice in the bus industry. They also consider the vehicle as it appears today in the National Collection. To what extent is it unique, and how original and authentic is the vehicle in its current form? In each case, they require somebody like the wonderful Alan Lambert from the South Down Omnibus Trust, who can guide them to the answers.
We've got a Leyland TD1 with a brush open top body. Completely original. It was originally preserved by Seth Den in 1950 when it was withdrawn, and it was kept for special events and as a museum piece, not as a PSV. And then in 1971, they decided to give it a little reprieve, and it had an overhaul, and it actually ran along Brighton Seafront in service for the summer of 71. After that, it was withdrawn, hidden away at the back of Port Slade Works, and never came out again, hardly at all. When Seth Den was sold to Stagecoach, they kept it as a museum piece, and it was kept until 2023, and we bought it.
And it's come home, in a way, hasn't it, to
totally.
Its vehicular friends and its human friends.
Yes, absolutely right. Yeah, it's got all its mates here.
There are a few features of this particular vehicle which are significant. Tell us about the inside of the lower saloon.
Where the seats stop going forwards and go sideways over the rear wheels, there's a little partition, both sides with glass in it, which separates the two areas.
And was this popular with the passengers?
Not for me when I was a little boy, definitely not. I rode on one during the war. 8 standing was out of fashion, and then probably 20 was nearer the mark. I got pushed right to the front and was scared stiff I'd never find my way off again. So I refused to ride on them thereafter. But fortunately, this was the only batch like it, so we didn't come across them very often.
As we look at it here, it's an open-top bus, but not always.
No, they were laid up at the beginning of the World War II. And then after a couple of years, Seth Den thought, well, blimey, we've got these 23 buses here, which are only 10 years old. We're not using them. We ought to be doing something with them. So they constructed canvas tops from material they had in stock for Sharabangs, and built these canvas tops with windows in over the whole of the top deck on all 23 of them. That enabled them to be used 7 days a week throughout the whole year, all through the war.
The Southdown TD1 is among several pre-war vehicles on display at Amberley Chalk Pits Museum in Sussex. And bus inspector Paul Statham is in his element amongst them.
Southdown Mason, the district of East Kent, all ran single deckers on bus routes during the week, and at weekends in particular, they ran them into Victoria for express services. And so the Tilling Stevens here has got a roof rack for the luggage.
So a very early example of what we later called dual purpose.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's absolutely right.
The Tilling Stevens bus in question, or coach on Sundays, dates back to 1930. But age alone doesn't necessarily make it a high scorer. Besides, compared to many vehicles in the National Collection, this is quite a modern vehicle. Over at the London Transport Museum's Acton Depot, the bus inspectors have been working through the collection chronologically, beginning with several early examples of London motor buses. Senior curator Katerina Morainen is about to take our breath away.
B340, which was set aside by the LGOC in 1924. It has now been in preservation for 100 years, and considering it was only in service from 1911 till 1924, that's a very long time. There are aspects of it where you think, OK, well, is this original or has it been done in preservation? Often we don't know because it's been in preservation for such a long time and the record keeping wasn't what it is today. Yeah, we're currently looking at the paintwork. We know it was done in the 70s, so we're touching it up a little bit before it goes into the gallery where we'll celebrate its 100 years in preservation.
Together, the early vehicles provide a masterclass in the evolution of the bus, demonstrating design developments such as enclosed driving cabs and upper deck saloons, four-wheel brakes, pneumatic tyres, and various improvements in passenger capacity and comfort along the way. Further down the line, in every sense, the bus inspectors are faced with a classic London Transport RT from the 1950s, suddenly looking very modern. It's the archetypal London bus of its time. But with this example, there's something not quite typical.
It is painted gold. The thing is, it was painted gold to celebrate, I suppose, the Queen's anniversary of some sort. And it did run in service, but probably not with London Transport. We think it had passed on to Arriva by then. So, yes, it did run in gold, and therefore it's a difficult one to score, really.
Well, let's see what you think, Peter. What do you think of a gold RT? If you had to score it out of three for livery authenticity, what would you say?
Taking into account the museum name on the side rather than London Transport, the general state of the vehicle, I would say.
It wouldn't be fair to tell you the provisional scores, especially when the bus is listening. But in the National Association's scoring and grading scheme, the current livery of a bus accounts for a very small proportion of the overall total, around 3%. That's because the livery is seen as a transient feature. Buses are repainted dozens of times in service, and potentially dozens of times in preservation too. And of course, the grading may be useful in securing funds for a major restoration project down the line, in which a vehicle's livery could well change. So, fans of gold RTs shouldn't worry unduly. You're listening to the Bus Inspectors Podcast, brought to you by the National Association of Road Transport Museums, a registered charity which represents heritage collections across the UK. As we've been hearing, the association is running a project to score and grade the nation's historic buses and coaches. And you can hear more in our other podcast episodes at thebusinspectors.com and wherever you found this one. Later, we'll be hearing about the many challenges involved in preserving our modern bus history.
Much more electronic, much more automatic, and frankly, much more difficult to manage.
All of this deteriorates a lot quicker than a simpler vehicle would.
And we'll zoom into the future to imagine how today's zero-emission electric buses might fare in tomorrow's preservation scene.
The engineering isn't so much spanners anymore as keyboards. It helps if the preservation group maybe has a computer nerd, but absolutely no reason why it shouldn't be possible to preserve those vehicles.
Grading may be new to the heritage bus world, but it's widely used elsewhere in the heritage sector. Tim Headley-Jones is the Executive Director of the Railway Heritage Trust, a not-for-profit company that is focused on restoring heritage on the main railway network, giving it new use and restoring it for appreciation.
We have grants that restore everything from station buildings, water towers, viaducts, boundary walls, turntables, you name it. If the railway built it, then we'll give a grant to help restore it.
Like the preserved bus sector, there is competition for resources in railway heritage. And Tim and his colleagues face similar dilemmas when deciding what to prioritise. Like the National Association of Road Transport Museums, they have developed grading mechanisms to help. For example, when it comes to signal boxes.
In 2012, we worked with Network Rail and Historic England to do a survey of signal boxes and decide, in anticipation of signal boxes being less needed by the operational railway, which ones should be saved and listed, and which ones should not be listed.
The signal box survey had some familiar criteria when it came to assessing the importance of one box over another.
One of the things that we really looked at was about the need to include typical examples of all types of signal boxes that a particular company might have. For example, the Midland Railway signal boxes are well represented. Caledonian Railway, for example, there are a large number of those. So ensuring a good spread of types that were saved, but not all styles could be saved. Literally, you couldn't save every single style of a type of signal box, but a good representative sample could be saved.
There may be some tough messages for those whose projects can't be supported.
If you live in a small community where there is a signal box that may not now be needed, we, as the Railway Heritage Trust, would support its demolition. Now, that's a hard answer to receive if you're in the local community and want to see it saved, but the reality of the operational railway is that it no longer needs large quantities of signal boxes. The reality of the heritage railway sector is that there is a limit on how many signal boxes they need. So, yes, we do get into difficult decisions and have to tell people that no, we can't support particular projects.
Tim is certain the Railway Heritage Trust scheme has ensured the prioritisation of limited funds to achieve the best possible strategic result for the nation.
It's been immensely useful because there were huge numbers of signal boxes and we literally can't support every single project involving a signal box. There are lots of restored signal boxes around, so it's not a case that we've completely lost them, but there does have to be a judgment as to which examples we save and how we save them.
In the same way, the scoring and grading being undertaken by the bus inspectors offers a mechanism for prioritisation of the most significant vehicles, those which best tell the UK's bus and coach story. And of course, that story is still evolving. Whilst the bus inspectors have been uncovering plenty of gems from the dawn of the motorbus, the roaring 20s, through the swinging 60s and 70s, they're also hearing about some gaps in our more modern bus history. Even at the London Transport Museum depot at Acton.
We have pretty much everything from the horse bus up until the 1980s. The very newest vehicle we have in the building is the Dennis Dart 1990. And we have one more vehicle in the collection that's newer than that, that's 2005. What we obviously haven't got that well represented is that period since privatisation and kind of what happened to London buses after that.
Senior curator Kat knows only too well there are some difficult decisions when it comes to collecting policy.
There's a huge variety of buses and of course we can't collect everything and so we have to be really selective. But where I would like to develop the collection in future is obviously having the more modern vehicles that represent the younger generations of bus enthusiasts who will be much more interested in the vehicles of their youth.
Maxon Goh is a bus enthusiast, creator and vlogger. And if you don't know what that is, check out his bus and coach videos on YouTube. Maxon is from a generation which many bus museums and collections have been slow to satisfy.
I grew up in the early 2000s, so the kind of buses that I would remember going to school on were things like the Volvo B10M or the Mercedes-Benz 0405 or even the Dennis Tridents. And those are the kind of vehicles that personally I have the most interest in and as a result would be the vehicles that I would want to preserve the most. For the older vehicles, I may not relate to them on a personal level, but I do find them interesting in the same way that I find old American classic cars, for example, also really interesting. An old half-cab bus to me is really beautiful to see and to enjoy, but personally, I wouldn't really want to own one.
On his YouTube channel, Maxon launched a poll and asked a question of his primarily younger audience.
If money wasn't an issue, would they rather preserve a 1930s Crosley or 1990s Volvo? About 600 plus votes and 90% of them or something similar voted for the Volvo.
as our interests change, as the interests of the people that follow us change, if it's true that younger people are more interested in vehicles that they've seen on the road when they were young,
we won't be able to save everything.
Not everything is going to be able to be saved. Vehicles built in the 40s, 50s, 60s may not all have homes in the next 30 years.
That was a shock to me, because I thought younger people liked the buses that they grew up with, but I didn't realise that it was to this extent.
Beauty is in the eyes of the YouTube viewer. It's a result that may surprise fans of older vehicles, but it's unlikely to come as a shock to generations of younger bus enthusiasts who commune around the vehicles that interest them.
There are groups, of course, like the Bromley Bus Preservation Group, which is mainly rear-engine buses. They tend to be of a kind of younger demographic. It's a group of private enthusiasts. And so there is appetite for preserving that generation of vehicles.
In effect, there's an entire running day known as the low-floor-ish running day, which is dedicated to, well, as the name suggests, low-floor vehicles. And you have loads of things that people would consider modern, like Volvo B7TLs, DAF DB250s, and of course the favourite Dennis Tridents.
But why are many of our established museums and collections struggling to represent our more modern bus history? Buses and coaches from the 90s and early 2000s.
Part of it is, I think, who's collecting. But the other key part of it is the maintenance of newer vehicles. It's very difficult to maintain modern vehicles because of the more complex electronics on them, the amount of plastics on them. All of this deteriorates a lot quicker than a simpler vehicle would. So if we take the 1911 B-Type, that's got no electronics on it. Everything on it is wood. If it deteriorates, you just replace it. Can't do that with a new Routemaster, for example. And the electronics, if they deteriorate, repairing those, it's not impossible, but it's a very different skill. And so you need an entirely different, separate skill set for that.
James Freeman is chairman of the Friends of King Alfred Buses, a well-known Winchester-based charity which has worked tirelessly to collect and restore buses and coaches which represent the former King Alfred fleet from across the decades. But when it came to taking the collection beyond 1971, there was a challenge.
I think the watershed for us and for King Alfred Motor Services was the arrival of the Metro Scania, a vehicle so different from its predecessors, much more electronic, much more automatic, and frankly, much more difficult to manage. And indeed, we had the fun of owning a Metro Scania, an ex-Newport one, on the basis that it looked a bit like the King Alfred ones, albeit a bit shorter. But we would have lived with that if we could only have coped with the vehicle itself.
For an experienced group like Friends of King Alfred Buses, with a team of enthusiastic volunteers, why was the Metro Scania such a problem?
The challenge was that there were so many things that went wrong with it that we couldn't easily fix because they were electronic, they involved bits and pieces that you just could not get anymore. And in the end, we had to make the decision to let the vehicle go because we just couldn't cope with it, frankly. And my experience looking around the collection of Metro Scanias, which you can finger on one hand. The only one that you can see running is in Leicester, and I know from my involvement with the Leicester Friends that it's an absolute uphill battle to keep that vehicle going. And so I think that the Metro Scania really does represent the moment when we swung over from things that you could fix and can fix to vehicles that are a completely different sort of challenge. And it's gone on from there, it's just got worse and worse.
Compared to their forebears, preservationists seeking to preserve buses from the 1990s onwards face a very different journey. Or for much of the time, no journey at all.
From my friends who have been preserving buses from the 2000s, the buses could be off the roads for a long period of time because of, like, say, an electrical problem or like an ECU problem, and, you know, it's just going to be undrivable and you can't enjoy it that way.
And it's not just the buses and coaches themselves which present a problem.
The other thing is diagnostics. With a Routemaster, if it's offing, you go and open the bonnet and look at it. You can't do that with today's vehicles. You need the laptop that you plug in. It needs to have the correct software, and that software only runs on the correct operating system. If you have the correct operating system, only a certain generation of laptops will support that, and on top of that, you need to be able to interpret it, and that's a separate skill altogether. So there's a huge amount of other skills that go into maintaining modern vehicles that have nothing to do with the skills that we have for maintaining Routemasters or B-types or any of the buses from the last 100 years that we have here.
All this brings us face to face with an elephant in the room, an almost inevitable conclusion about how the heritage bus world will need to adapt and change.
Up to now, we've always had the ambition that the best thing to do with buses is to have them running. And that's still true, isn't it? And the ability to share a bus by getting a whole lot of people on it and taking for them a ride is something which puts bus preservation in a different place from trucks, for example, or tanks or things like that. The challenge of these more modern vehicles is that as they become impossible to run, they'll end up standing in corners, ignored, which is a very bad thing, and if we can get them on public display, so much the better. But that creates a whole new problem of its own, which is that if you think about it, the vast bulk of the national collection of vehicles is hidden away in one place or another and not at all accessible to the public. So if you're saying actually all these preserved vehicles are going to be only accessible if you can actually get people to go and look at them where they're standing, that's going to be another challenge all of its own, and one wonders how that would be achieved.
Even for some of the UK's biggest and most accessible museums, static display of modern vehicles isn't practical.
Another reason why our newest vehicle isn't here at Acton is simply that it doesn't fit. It's enormous, and we don't have any space.
For private preservationists, museums, charities, and other organisations, there's a voyage of discovery ahead. As James suggested, their challenges mirror those which the operators themselves have faced over the years as the sophistication of their new buses has grown. Indeed, history never stops, and in 2025, the bus world is facing another enormous technological step change. Stéphane Baguette is from Alexander Dennis, the market-leading manufacturer for buses in the UK.
The transition to zero-emission mobility is in full swing. I think over the last year or so, it's become very clear that battery electric buses are the main zero-emission mode of transport that we are going to have. For us at Alexander Dennis, over the last year, we launched our next generation of electric buses. Passengers, quiet ride on an electric vehicle, a pleasant journey certainly, even more pleasant than on our low emission diesel buses. For operators, it's a great opportunity to have a sustainable technology that in terms of the operational cost protects their bottom line with highly efficient electric vehicle technology, components that are long lasting, and we're doing a lot on our part, especially around the batteries, to make sure that they can last a sizable chunk, if not the whole vehicle life, with the operator.
With more complex technology in play, the relationship between operators and manufacturers is also undergoing transformation. Alexander Dennis aren't merely the builder.
It is becoming a much more longer-term partnership between us and our customers, the bus operators and the transport authorities in those places where they're involved as well. It starts before the buses has even been ordered, working with our customers on very detailed route modelling, where we take a lot of information about the route or combination of routes that the buses are intended to be run on, the timetable, topographical information, climate information about the location they'll be running in, and we're putting that to very sophisticated automotive industry standard simulation tools to very accurately predict how the electric bus, and crucially its batteries of course, will perform under those operating conditions. The relationship continues after the delivery of the buses, the wide range of services, everything from parts, field support, workshops, training, and then telematics especially. We're able to effectively work with the operator, have our engineers also keep an eye on the buses, see how they're performing, to identify if perhaps one of the buses, while absolutely meeting its daily requirements, is perhaps using a little bit more energy than the others in the fleet. And then we can drill down into that and find out the root cause of that and probably, you know, run a software update.
Given the need for lifelong support from the manufacturer, where will this leave future preservationists when the time comes to try and save these vehicles for posterity?
Preserving an electric vehicle is somewhat complicated necessarily, but there are additional considerations perhaps compared with preserving a classic diesel bus. An electric bus obviously needs a charging infrastructure of some sort. There's a lot of electronics involved that control everything. The engineering isn't so much spanners anymore as keyboards. It helps if the preservation group maybe has a computer nerd somewhere in it. There's different elements going into it, but absolutely no reason why it shouldn't be possible to preserve those vehicles with the right support from us and from operators across the industry, you know, in a similar way to how we and operators across the industry are already supporting the preservation of previous generations of vehicles.
Stefan's optimism is reassuring to hear. But it's clear that preservation itself would need to embrace dramatic change in order to accommodate such sophisticated vehicles. Today's preservationists will often be heard bemoaning the rising cost of 6 and 12 volt batteries for their Bedford SBs and Dennis Lowlines, now at hundreds of pounds a time. Could private preservationists or museums and charities ever run to the tens of thousands of pounds needed to replace batteries in an electric bus? Max and Go recognises the challenge.
It would certainly be a lot harder to keep more modern buses on the roads. However, as I like to say, when there's a will, there's a way. And if people are equally committed to preserve these more modern buses, then I would think it's possible, just that it's going to need a lot more money and a lot more time and a lot more communication and cooperation with bus operators, with the manufacturers, to offer the kind of post-service life support that is required for these buses to continue running.
With all these present and future challenges, the work of the bus inspectors seems to be ever more important. A means of identifying and prioritising the most important survivors to guide evolution of the national collection. As people and organisations come and go, interests and technologies change, and history just keeps on happening. And on the subject of important vehicles, did you guess what was being talked about earlier?
Possibly a bit overlooked, you know, it's a humble single decker. It doesn't perhaps look as iconic as a Routemaster on the streets of London, but there have been more of them on the streets of London alone than there ever were Routemasters, let alone in the rest of the country.
The humble Dennis Dart.
Personally, as Alexander Dennis, we feel that the Dennis Dart is possibly the most significant bus in British bus building history, in the way that it defined the modern MIDI bus for the whole world.
One for discussion in a future episode of the Bus Inspectors podcast.
We've already got over 22,000 Dennis Darts and successors built, and great work being done by lots of preservationists preserving those earlier Dennis Darts and low-floor Dennis Darts and Enviro 200s.
We'd love to know what you think about this and all the issues discussed in this episode of the Bus Inspectors podcast. Get in touch on our social channels and at thebusinspectors.com. The Bus Inspectors podcast was presented and produced by me, David Shepherd. Our guests were Tim Headley-Jones, Alan Lambert, Katerina Morainen, Maxon Goh, James Freeman, and Stefan Baguette, with appearances from Andrew Wickham, Lord Peter Hendy, Leon Daniels, Claire Fairbrother, Stephen Booth, Paul Statham, and a gold RT. Our thanks go to the Railway Heritage Trust, Alexander Dennis, the South Down Omnibus Trust, and Amberley Chalk Pits Museum, the London Transport Museum, and all at their Acton Depot, and to all the museums and collections visited by the Bus Inspectors so far. The Bus Inspectors podcast was brought to you by the National Association of Road Transport Museums.